Hey everyone, welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. My name is Bert Vinert. Today is March 9th, and I'm really excited to share this conversation with you today. I recently had the privilege of appearing on the Voluntary Life Podcast. Jake DeSillis, the host, invited me to discuss a very important topic, one we have not explored for a while, and it is conformity. One of those things that we identified early on as a hidden lesson of school. Again, this is episode 197 of The Voluntary Life. The title is Resisting Conformity, a discussion with Brett Vinert, which is my real name. If you're new, nobody is named Bert Vinert. That is a ridiculous name. Imagine that. You know, a couple in the maternity ward, and they're, you know, holding their newborn, and one says to the other, hey, honey, you know, what's our last name here? Vinert? How about Bert? Would that work? No, it wouldn't work. And in this discussion, we talk about how conforming to quote-unquote normal spending habits can prevent people from achieving financial independence, like if they get trapped in a particular job. We're going to talk about Solomon Asch's study in conformity, as well as a few other experiments and what we can learn from them. We're going to talk about how conformity can actually alter a person's perception, which is pretty scary, according to some of these studies. And then we'll talk about some strategies for resisting, the importance of having allies in certain situations or with certain topics, the role of privacy in reducing conformist tendencies. And we'll also finish up with Nathaniel Brandon's six practices or pillars of self-esteem and how they are helpful in cutting your own path through a world that demands some level of conformity. So I really appreciate Jake having me on. He's been on School Sucks a few times in the past. He helped me wrap up our Presence and Productivity series, and I interviewed him on July 4th about his new book. So go to schoolsucksproject.com and search Jake DeSillis, DeSyllas, DeSillis. And please visit thevoluntarylife.com to see more of his work. It lines up really, really nicely with ours, I think. So I just got back from the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, feeling very energized by that whole experience. I had the opportunity to talk a little bit with some listeners, some who had traveled from as far away as Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And starting on Wednesday, I'll be releasing all of my Liberty Forum discussions. I want to say a huge thanks to everyone who supports the show through either our AV Club or our Amazon wishlist. It was because of you folks. I was able to do twice as many Liberty Forum interviews as I had done in the previous 2 years because I did not have to rely on the availability of the Free Talk Live equipment. I've got my own mobile setup now that I bring. So it worked out really well, but we'll talk more about that event on Wednesday. Here's my conversation with Jake. Thanks for listening and take care.
You're listening to The Voluntary Life, where you can hear ideas for finding freedom in an unfree world. Visit thevoluntarylife.com to connect with the show and hear all past episodes. Here's your host, Jake.
Hi everyone, it's Jake here. Welcome to another episode of The Voluntary Life. This week we're going to talk about conformity, and I want to share some really interesting findings to do with conformity. And I'm going to do this as a discussion with Brett Vinert, who runs the School Sucks podcast. Hi, Brett.
Hey, Jake. It's great to be on. I think this is the first time I've ever been on your show.
Yes. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for having me on your show in the past. I think people may have heard you on the feed because I've been on a couple of your shows. Yep. But it's great that to be able to have you on. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about this. And so I wanted to tell you a little bit about why I got in touch with you about having this discussion today. Because I've been writing a book about different ways to quit the rat race, looking at, you know, opportunities to move beyond employment and either become an entrepreneur, but also find other ways to find as much freedom as possible in your own life. And that's really what The Voluntary Life has always been about. And as I've been researching this, I've looked into some of the practical constraints and financial constraints that you need to overcome if you want to have as much independence and freedom as possible. But I've also been looking at some of the more psychological constraints. And in particular, when it comes to trying to get more financial independence and getting to a point where you can do what you want with your time and you're not, you know, beholden to a job that you don't want to do, one of the really important things that I keep coming up against and keep looking at in all of the research that I've done and all the thinking I've done about this is conformity. And in particular, there are practical constraints and there are real difficulties to gaining financial freedom in the world that we inhabit now. But compared to our ancestors, you know, even a few generations ago, and compared to many other places in the world, in the West now, the opportunity to create, you know, significant freedom for yourself is so huge. The practical constraints are still there, but one of the biggest constraints, I think, is the psychological constraint of conformity. And in particular, it's conformity to a lifestyle pattern and a culture that I call the culture of capital consumption, which is a lifestyle which is based on spending on comfort items to make yourself feel better because you hate your job and you're not living in a life that's authentic to your true self. It's a culture that keeps people in debt, and it's a culture that encourages taking out huge mortgages on much more house than you need, with the idea that this is the one big financial, quote, investment that you'll make in life. But it's not really an investment. It's consumption. And it's a culture that's really built on inflation and the idea that, you know, it's better to spend your money now before it loses value rather than save for the future, because what's the point? And breaking that culture and breaking that conformity is something that's really hard for people to do. And as I've been reading and thinking about this, a quote from you, Brett, came into my mind that I don't know when I heard this, but it was a while ago. And it was just, you know, it's one of those times where something really makes a huge impression. This made a big impression on me. And you said, school really teaches three things. It teaches obedience, it teaches conformity, and it teaches apathy. And that's been really, really inspiring to me, you know, hearing you talk about the kind of messages that school brings in, because I've now been thinking about how does that go on after school into the way that people live, and in particular, into the way that if you want to gain more freedom in your life, how does that affect you? So that's why I wanted to get you on today to talk about conformity, because I wanted to let you know that, you know, you talking about this has been a real inspiration to me, and it's led me to look into things like the Ash experiment and that we're going to talk about. But that's the sort of background from how I got interested in this question of conformity. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate you saying so, too. You know, just to jump back to something, a lot of good stuff in what you just said. It's kind of like the psychological contributes to the financial, where so many people feel like they have these holes that need to be filled and they keep pouring. But they're, you know, they're emotional holes, they're psychological holes in the true self, the actualized self. And they keep pouring all of these costly things into it. And it never seems to be full. And I know what that's like from experience. I feel like I lived that way for a long time. And I remember just having tremendous dissatisfaction with work and having to come up with like new stories to tell myself. And I actually just wrote a foreword for a book about the book was about child protective services. And it was my foreword was about working outside the system. And it was just like every year I had to reassess, like, I can't do this anymore. What else in this field that I'm trained in can I do? Because this job is terrible. So yeah, I think a lot of people deal with that stress and that frustration. And as far as those three lessons of school, which was really, I think, a condensation in the early days of School Sucks podcast, I presented that as a condensation of probably something John Taylor Gatto had written at some point. I believe he had seven lessons as a school teacher, and those three were certainly in the mix there. But it's kind of cumulative. Like, obedience, I think, is really, really first. But we'll discover today that obedience feeds conformity, especially when we look at a study like the one that Solomon Ash did. And obedience and conformity both contribute to not just a personal apathy, but also, you know, a philosophical apathy, a political apathy as well. So I think obedience will come up a lot in the discussion. But if conformity can be broken, there are definitely the potential for some interesting payoffs.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things that if you want to achieve more freedom in your life, and even if you just want to individuate and live your life to your own full potential, then conformity is something that everyone comes up against and is a challenge for everyone. Because, yeah. you know, that's the problem with conformity is that it stops you from being your own individual self and for going for what is going to fulfill you, because you feel this pull of, you know, you must not do something different to the norm. And the problem is the norm is itself deeply problematic, you know, as I was talking about, especially in terms of financial life. The norm is the kind of lifestyle that's not going to give you freedom. It's going to involve spending all your capital and not actually getting to a point where you can do what you want with your time because you have the freedom that that can provide. So I think, you know, it's often easy to focus on the big forces of the state and people out there and so forth. The interesting thing about conformity is that it's much more insidious. It works in personal relationships and it works inside ourselves, I think. It's a kind of social control thing that stops people from achieving their lives. It's really sad because it's not, you know, if you can break conformity and there are ways to overcome it, but I think a lot of people are not even aware of just how huge the pressure to conform is and how much of a shaping influence it has on all of us if we're not conscious of it.
Yeah. And that's a really important distinction that you made there, too. I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, if it wasn't for bad government, I could do this, this and this. You know, my life would be so much better if it wasn't for bad government. But a lot of us have these kind of bad governments installed in our psyche, you know,
right?
And
absolutely.
That's something that I think needs to be identified. It's something that we really have to pay attention to. And it's something that we have to try and consciously and actively break out of. And obviously, conformity, it's really easy to fall into the conformity trap if you're not living consciously, especially in groups where you identify or you feel comfortable with most of the members, you know?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And so as I was thinking about this topic, I looked into, you know, what do we know about conformity? What kind of information or evidence out there is there about how conformity works and about how you can break it and how you can achieve, you know, more independence from the pull of conformity? And I came across this study by Solomon Ash, which I sent you a link to, and you were saying that you were aware of this study that he did back in the 50s.
I feel like we must have covered this on my show before at some point. I just can't remember when. But when I was reading through it, yeah, it looked pretty familiar.
Yeah, I wondered. I did search on your shows, and I found lots to do with Milgram and the obedience experiments. But the conformity experiments by Ash were a little bit earlier, and they were different because they were specifically about conformity. And I found out what's interesting is that Ash was actually Milgram's supervisor. He trained Milgram, and you can very much see the influence of Ash on the Milgram experiments. So maybe it would be useful to say a little bit about these experiments. Shall I just give a brief overview of what happened and what they're about?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So basically, Solomon Ash was a psychologist, and he wanted to find out how strong is the pull of conformity. And he said the reason that he did this is, or one of the things that led him to think about this was that he had a memory as a child. He came from Poland and he went to the States. He emigrated in between the wars, and he had a memory as a child of, I think, his grandfather or one of his the elders in his family telling him this story about a glass of wine. There was an additional glass of wine put out on some festival. And Solomon, as a child, said, who's that for? And they said, oh, this is for the prophet, so-and-so, whoever it is. And this kid, Solomon Ash, said, well, what's going to happen? And they said, well, if you watch very carefully, you'll see that he'll drink the wine. And so this kid heard the story and found himself staring at this wine, you know, wondering, like, and he thought he could see the wine go down just a little bit. And Solomon Ash realized as an adult that, you know, the power of that suggestion had been so strong to his impressionable mind as a child that he thought he was seeing, you know, the wine actually go down. And so he got him thinking about how strong is the power of conform, you know, the desire to conform, how much can it affect not just your will, your desire to not stand out because you know it's going to offend other people, but how much can it affect what you actually think And that, I think, is a really interesting question, too. How much can
it's really, yeah, it's a scary question.
It's a scary question, right. How much can it warp your perception? And so what he did was he constructed this experiment. And he, of course, like many of these psychological experiments, it was in a university, involved getting university students in. And they were told that they were going to do an experiment in perception, and accuracy of perception or something like that. And so they'd all sit in this room. There'd be about four or five of them. And they'd be shown two cards. And on one card, there's one line. And on another card, there's three lines of varying lengths. And they had to say which line most closely, well, which line was the same length as the first card. So they carry on this experiment, and for the first couple of rounds, it's pretty uneventful. You know, they're all just going through, and they have to say out the answer. So they're each going through, and they all say the same thing. So they're saying number one, number one, number one, number one. And they go through, and nothing really happens. It all seems rather boring. And then what happens is that the experimenter shows the three alternate lines, and the first person suddenly says a really bizarre answer, like number three, when it's obviously not number three. And then the second person says, number three, number three. And it gets to the last guy, and he says, number three, too. And what you find out later is that actually everyone in the room is part of the experiment except the last guy. And all of the others are dummies, and they've been put there to deliberately say the false answer, to pick a line that is not the same length as the first card. And the question is, how many people would change their answer when they see the other people picking another line? It's a super interesting setup for an experiment, I think.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
So, and what he found, what's interesting is that basically what he found is that 37% of the critical trials, that's a trial where they're showing the wrong line, people went with the majority, even though the majority was wrong. So 37% of the time, people could see that a line was a different length, but when everyone else in the room beforehand had said, you know, a certain answer, they answered the same way. And what's interesting about this is no authority figure. These are peers. So these are just other students who are all, you know, they don't have any authority. It's not like a guy in a white coat in the way that it was in the Milgram experiment. And they're not being told, you must do this, which is what the Milgram experiment is about. Will you obey authority? They're not told that they have to do anything except judge which line is the same length. And 37% of the time, they just go along with what everyone else in the room says. And
yeah,
that's an interesting finding. You know, that I think that's really interesting. What's even more interesting, though, is that when he asked people who went along with it, it split between, I mean, obviously you, people giving their explanations, you know, what they say and what really happened, you can't necessarily tell. But there was a split between those people who genuinely thought, well, I must be wrong. I just must be wrong. They're all, everyone else is choosing a different line. And a lot of people gave that as the explanation. And the other explanation was that there were people who knew that it was the wrong line, but they didn't want to be different. They didn't want to stand out. And so they, yeah, you know, they deliberately, I mean, they consciously just chose the same answers as the others.
Yeah. You know, there's something that's actually kind of encouraging about this study, and it's often left out of the discussions that I've heard about it anyway, is that you mentioned initially it just starts with people giving the right answers, right?
Yes.
Like the four Confederates before this test subject are giving the right answers, but then they start saying the wrong line is,
yes,
the longest. What happened was in the actual experiment, the test subject, the person who wasn't in on it, would initially go against the group more than 37%. They would say, no, what are you talking about? It's this line. Mm. And it turns out that they were worn down over time.
Yes.
You know, after the four Confederates. So there's interesting statements there about the schooling process, about social conformity or cultural conformity for adults. There's interesting statements there about the political system, but there's also something encouraging there that this is not, you know, the default human response to say, oh, well, that's what the group thinks, or actually believing what the group says, that they did persist initially.
Yeah.
But then would eventually back down.
Yeah, they got worn down. And after a couple of trials, that's right, then it's sort of a cumulative effect. And, you know, that's an interesting point you make. And the reason that I want to talk about this study is, I mean, it's interesting like as a little curiosity, but I think the most interesting thing about it is what can we learn about ways to defend yourself against the pressure of conformity? And there's lots of things that I think come out of this that we can really learn that help to understand how conformity works. So, for example, the most successful thing that they found to help people not conform was having an ally. So once you put an ally in the group, so it's not a unanimous majority of people who are saying the wrong line, but there's one other guy who says the correct line. Soon as that happened, the conformity fell massively, and it's a tiny fraction of before. I think it's like 5% or something like that. But that, I thought, is really interesting because that has direct implications for us to think about how do you, you know, strengthen yourself against conformity. And having allies is really important. Finding people who are willing to, you know, look at reality and point out something and you know, not to be conformed to you know, lies or propaganda or whatever the circumstances is super important. And I think that's a very helpful finding because it tells us something about what we need in order to really go for the lives that we want to live. We need allies who will support us and who will respect our decisions and also who will validate what we see about the self-destructiveness of the culture around us, for example.
Yeah, it's like the whole concept of the support group where, you know, I think that if somebody might look at this experiment for the first time and they would see this dichotomy between, well, you're either a lamb or you're a renegade, right. You know, and there isn't much in between. But, you know, the partnership variation in this experiment that takes it from 37% yielding to about 5% yielding is really important. When this unanimity is punctured, the power of the group is diminished significantly. Mm. You know, so that's really key.
Yeah. Do you want to hear a couple of freaky findings that I thought were kind of interesting? Other things that came out of it.
Yeah, sure.
One of the things was Solomon Asch tried to say, he basically said, well, let's see how far we can push this, right? So let's make the lines obscenely different. You know, let's just make it so totally obvious. And he doesn't say what the percentage was, but he found that there was some proportion who would conform even when, you know, I think it was more than 7 inches difference between the lines. You know,
it's like,
it's getting to the point where it's just mind-bogglingly obvious that these two lines are completely different, but some people would still conform. And that, you know, that I think that's pretty creepy and yeah. Interesting to know. And again, this is a low stakes environment. You know, we're not talking about politics or, you know, anything like that. We're talking about lines on a paper amongst a bunch of university students. And if that situation can be enough to make people feel the pressure of conformity, then what about people who've been through public schooling and had all this indoctrination and been told that, you know, you need to get a safe job and buy a house and do this and pay your taxes and so on and so forth? You know, those are much more sort of high stakes messages in a way. So I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, we get a lot of practice with conformity because through our most formative years, there's these very clear threats in penalties attached to nonconformist behavior, you know, and it's at a time, too, where we're very powerless. It's a kind of place where the partnership variation doesn't matter. You know, like when 2 9-year-olds team up against their elementary school, you know, they're going to be out of luck.
Right.
But by the time people get to this happened at a university, right? So these were mostly college students. It's that same concept that I mentioned, worn down by time.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's the explanation of why, even when it's totally low stakes and what we're talking about is a couple of lines on a page, why people still feel a strong pressure to conform because they've already been through that whole experience of school and parenting and years and years and years of feeling extremely uncomfortable and seeing, you know, bad results from not conforming. That means that in a way people just kind of run along the set lines of what the surrounding culture and people around them expect of them without even really being conscious of it, without thinking of it. I mean, that one of the other kind of scary findings was that even when Ash talked to the people after the experiment was over and explained what it was all about and talked to them about their conformity and why they had conformed and so forth, everyone who was a conformist consistently underestimated the amount that they had conformed. So everyone underestimated the number of trials that they had picked the wrong one on.
Were they all aware of it, though? Were they all aware that they had, you know, gone against their judgment?
No, that's the interesting thing, is that there was a split. There were those people who did not trust their judgment, and they said, I must be wrong. I must be wrong. The other people, everyone else thinks it's that, so I must be wrong. They didn't trust their judgment, and so they conformed because they assumed that they were wrong. That was one group. Then there was another group who did know the other people must be getting it wrong, but they didn't want to go against the group. And they had justifications from it. Like, apparently one justification was, I didn't want to spoil the result by standing out or whatever. But I think these are just ways of saying, I didn't want to stand out. I didn't want to be different, you know?
Yeah, there's another way of thinking about what you just said. It can be divided into essentially three categories of conformity. So there would be action conformity, which is where the subjects know the majority is wrong, but they act in accordance anyway. So there's some of that. There's judgment conformity, which is where they say, well, you know, if everyone else says so, I mean, I see what's up here, but I'm going to reject my own judgment. Mm. And then the scary one that we mentioned before, the third type of conformity, is perception conformity, where they actually believe the group. So, you know, the perception conformity or the judgment conformity kind of relate to what I think Solomon identified in that study as informational conformity.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And the action conformity is what he called normative conformity, which is just essentially an apprehension, knowing that the group is wrong, but not wanting to make waves, a kind of obedience, right?
Yes, yeah.
And self-denial.
Yeah, exactly. I think it is also important to say that there was a group who didn't conform, who never conformed, whatever the circumstances. And apparently it was about a quarter of the people. So that's also kind of a hopeful thing, too, that people are capable of not conforming and of actually just standing by their own judgment, regardless of being, you know, a minority of one. And those people who were able to do it, it's interesting. What he says is that it wasn't that they were undisturbed by the others, but they were able to regain their balance and trust in their own judgment. So the ones who didn't conform, it's not that they, you know, were just completely zoned out and it didn't affect them emotionally. They did notice what was going on, and it was disturbing to them, but they still were able to have, I think he puts it like, to regain their composure and trust in their own judgment. And some of them also, they either trusted in their judgment, like, I know I'm right because that I can see it right in front of my face, the evidence of my senses, or they trusted in their values. You know, because another thing that he said was that some people who didn't conform said, well, I felt I had to call it like I saw it. And that, I think that response was, you know, well, this is super weird. Everyone else is saying something else, but I'm going to trust in my values, which is I'm just going to give a truthful response. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I see. So I think that's interesting that there are people who don't conform.
Yeah, that's actually a really encouraging number, 25%. And in maybe a social or a political context, it's enough for a revolution, but probably not a peaceful one, probably not the kind of one that you and I would like to have.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And also, you know, we're talking 25% where there's nothing at stake here. These are just plain lines on a page.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, when we're talking about, you know, becoming an entrepreneur, going outside the kind of employee paradigm, or challenging the political state and, you know, all of the sort of immoral acts that it does. These are things where there's a lot more at stake, and where breaking conformity can be more challenging, you know.
Yeah. Another footnote here. Have you ever looked at the Byrne study that was done in 2005?
No. What was that?
Well, I think it was Burns actually tried to replicate a lot of what Ash had done. The full name, if people want to look it up, is Neurobiological Correlates of Social Conformity and Independence During Mental Rotation. And he basically just made the test a little more complex. He would rotate these three-dimensional shapes like side by side, and people would have to say yes or no whether it was the same shape.
Right.
In some cases, the difference were just as obvious as the lines, but he still got 41% yielding.
Really?
Now, because this study was done decades after the other, he actually had the benefit of using brain scans, MRIs. And what he was trying to identify is where was the conformity occurring.
Oh, right.
And what he found, which was very interesting, was that it was actually in the occipital parietal network of the brain, which suggested to him, and people can look into this further because I'm certainly not a neurology expert, that it was actually perception. It was perception,
right,
that was causing the yielding. It wasn't action or judgment conformity, that people believed what the group said because everybody else in the group said it. The experiment, as far as subject versus confederates, was set up the same way.
Right.
So when they were that outnumbered without a partner, they yielded at 41%, which was slightly higher than Ash's results.
I mean, that's the scariest thing of all, isn't it? To think that, you know, the drip, drip, drip of pressure to conform can change your perception. And you mm-hmm. can actually, you know, you can actually misperceive reality purely because your social reality is telling you, no, you know, black is white. You know?
Yeah.
That's
so it's not just a weakness of conviction.
Right, right, right. Yeah. I mean, that's actually kind of what Solomon Ash was trying to get to when with the story from his childhood. It was, you know, he thought he saw the cup go down. Mm-hmm, he mm-hmm. actually had that perceptual change. So it's interesting. There's another thing that came out of the study that I think is relevant and useful in terms of finding conformity. And that was an interesting finding about the role of privacy. So what he found was that when the results didn't have to be said out loud, mm-hmm. they could be written down, then people were much more independent. And that's interesting because that's, you know, that to me says something about the role of privacy and boundaries in life. You know, if you are forced to live kind of completely in with the herd, so to speak, it's harder to differentiate yourself, to have time to introspect, reflect, to gain your own sense of self and independence. And privacy has a role, I think, in individuating and becoming your own person. You know, it's important to be able to shut the door on the pressures of the outside world and decide your own sort of space. And obviously I'm reading a lot into the implications of just the fact that they were less conforming when they wrote it down. But I think it's important that when people didn't have to sort of stand up in this room of all the other people and, you know, say their answer differently, then they were able to be more independently minded. And therefore I presume they were less perceptually altered as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So with the written variation yielding dropped by 2/3, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's been replicated in other studies that were done in public. There is, I can't remember the name of it, but there's one study that's done like on a public street where people who are Confederates duck down as if they're walking under a rope.
Oh, right, right.
And other people will just start to do it almost unconsciously.
Yeah.
Like they'll see the people in front of them do it and they'll just, you'll see their body contort when they get to that point, even though there is no rope there.
Right, right.
So the not having privacy, because like if you think about that a little bit differently, like just, you know, somebody watching a video of that, not in public, they would say, what are they doing? What
yeah.
are they ducking under, you know?
Yeah.
Assuming the video was good enough quality that they could see that there was no line there.
Yeah. And also someone watching a video of the Ash experiments with the lines, you know, if you're not in the room being forced to conform, then you're much more likely to look at the screen and think, what are these idiots doing? You know, this is so obviously not the right line, you know.
It does look very silly. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're not under the same conformity pressure. There are other things that you think are useful to think about in terms of how to defend yourself against the pressure of conformity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most important ones is living consciously, right? It's difficult. I mean, we can live more consciously in those situations we just described, watching these things on video. We have nothing at stake. We're not feeling those social pressures. So we are not as reactive as some of those people. We don't feel as apprehensive as some of those people. But those people, I think if they brought more consciousness to that situation, a consciousness that we're trying to raise in people, I think, by saying, you know, don't be paranoid, but people are trying to trick you. People do want you to conform so they can predict your behavior. So we can have a more, you know, efficient collectivistic society versus an individualistic one, which is very unruly and inefficient, according to the people in charge. So having a political, a historical, an educational context for the world in which we live, I think allows us to approach situations, to approach groups that would demand that kind of conformity or collectivism. And just by being aware of what's going on, and also being aware, part of living consciously is understanding how that affects us, we would be in a better position to combat those demands. I think that's really important. And what goes with that perfectly is this word skepticism, you know, and I'll say it again, like especially in the groups we identify with, because it's very easy. Like support groups are good, obviously, because it's good to get validation. You know, if somebody's struggling with a specific issue, you know, like a gambling problem or a weight problem or a substance abuse issue, they can feel a pretty alone in a world where people are not conforming. Where people are conforming to the behavior of not doing that thing, right? So they can feel isolated. So having people who have the same problem that you can talk to is obviously very valuable. But there's also the danger of becoming comfortable, right? With like, it's, you know, you do shows about achieving financial independence, being an entrepreneur. Who would you suggest that people who have those ambitions hang out with, you know, not losers, not, you know, couch potatoes or people who have settled for, you know, some traditional work path? It would probably be to find go-getters, you know? Yeah. So when a support group can turn into a kind of apathy group very easily.
I think that's a really, really important point, that when you grow up amongst the pressure of conformity, then what can happen is that people can break out of conformity to mainstream culture, and then they can become conformist to a subculture.
Yes.
And they can become just as conformist to that subculture. And they think they're super independent and radical and so forth because they're no longer part of the mainstream. But actually, the subculture can have its own crazy irrational rules and crazy irrational norms. And so this is the kind of danger of conformity, is that if you don't live consciously in the way that you describe, Brett, if you don't actually gain more consciousness about yourself and your life and understand yourself better, then if you try to become nonconformist, then the risk is that you just jump from not conforming to one group to conforming to another. And the fascinating thing is that Ash actually kind of did show this in one of his experiments, because he looked at what would happen if there was a dissenter among the majority who was saying the wrong thing. What would happen if there was a dissenter who said a different result, but it wasn't necessarily the right result? Maybe they said something that was like the majority said a really wrong result, like the really longest line, and the dissenter said a line that was quite long, but still, you know, still wrong, still not the correct line. What effect would that have? And what he found is that when you have a dissenter who has moderate views, as he called them, which seemed more plausible than the majority, then the person would be influenced by that dissenter. And they would often get it wrong because of the dissenter. Whereas fascinatingly, when you had a dissenter who had extremist views, so in other words, if there was somebody else in the experiment who was making wild guesses that were totally wrong, then that had more of a freeing effect on the person who was doing the experiment. Because I think the reason for that is they were able to say, well, these guys are wrong, that guy's way off, so I'm going to come up with my own view, like in this circumstance. And I think what that means is that in terms of the implications, I think if you want to be a critical thinker, if you want to be independent-minded, then you have to understand all the different sides of an argument. You have to be able to read the pro and the anti for any debate and be able to empathize with it so that you actually, you're not just like in the rah, 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 one side against the other mentality, but you're able to actually have a more objective view and say, well, these guys say this and that guy says that. So what do I really think? And that, I think, helps people to be more conscious and to actually come to a more critical view. And what I take from that is just how important it is to educate ourselves. I mean, this very much plugs into your show, is that to be our own educators so that we go out and we find out if there's an issue that we're interested in, read both sides, read all sides of it, and understand what the sort of different viewpoints are so that you can actually form your own opinion rather than being on team A or team B.
Yeah. And I think there's like an emotional untangling that needs to be done as well. One of the topics that I'm looking forward to exploring on my show in the future, we're currently doing this series called Scientific Consensus versus Scientific Dissent. And in these scientific conversations, man, people get upset at each other if they're on different sides of an issue. And is it just intolerance for other people's opinions? Because a lot of the people, I think, in other situations are more tolerant. And one of the things I wanted to explore was this psychology of being wrong or feeling wrong, or not the psychology of being wrong, the psychology of not knowing something and the emotional implications of that, right? So a lot of people bring all this emotion into what is a critical thinking exercise, and that can really, really screw up the critical thinking process. So learning a kind of emotional intelligence is really important in these situations too. I mean, this totally relates back to what we started with, the Ash study. It's not, I said line three is the longest because I'm a complete idiot, you know, or I don't have good vision. It was because of emotional reasons more often than not.
Yeah.
So being able to develop an emotional intelligence, again, in a consciousness of our emotional state, is really, really intertwined in what you're describing there as far as that critical thinking practice is concerned.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And that comes through in the people who were nonconformists, the people who were never, you know, bent out of shape by these crazy results that the majority were doing. Those guys said, you know, as I said before, when they talked to Ash afterwards, that, yeah, they did feel uncomfortable, but they were able to have that feeling and still, you know, trust their judgment. And so I think that's emotional maturity, is have a feeling and not act on it, you know, not just unconsciously act on it, but to be able to have the feeling, sit with it, and then decide consciously what your action is. It's that there's a lovely Viktor Frankl quote, which I've mentioned a few times on the podcast, which is that between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space is our freedom. And
that is the official quote of School Sucks Podcast.
Oh, is it? Right,
Pretty much.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly, when you talk about emotional intelligence, that's what I think of. I think of the ability to take your emotional inputs, your feelings that come up, and to be able to, you know, acknowledge them and know about them and be conscious of them without knee-jerk responses, you know?
Yeah, I did a show just yesterday with this gentleman named Kyle who studies Buddhism and meditation. And he had this metaphor about, you know, so many people are out there trying to cover the earth in leather, you know, instead of just realizing they can put shoes on and control the terrain over which they step. And I think that that's been on my mind because I think it's a great metaphor. But in these situations where people are tested in these circumstances, I would kind of like to know, what are they bringing with them into the experiment, right? Because if their internal world was particularly chaotic, right? So it shows you just how broad a subject conformity is. If their internal world is all chaotic, they might want, in this group situation, the path of least resistance. So it would be interesting. It might not just be a type of person. You know, I'm just a renegade by nature. Well, I'm just a lamb or a sheep by nature. It could have actually been situational. You know what I mean?
In terms of the situation of their background or their life or the situation of the experiment, which not quite sure which situation you mean.
What happened to them that morning?
Oh,
how many things they were dealing with in their personal lives? You know, so that was that conversation that I had yesterday with Kyle made me think of that. If somebody's own world seemed out of control in a group context, it would just be like, yeah, whatever's easiest, you know, yeah. or it could turn into, or that could be a reason for nonconformity or obstinance in the group. You know, if they just like, I'm angry at this group and I'm going to defy this group because I just needed this to be easy and go well, and now I'm confused. So what I'm bringing up here is that there's actually an important context that I haven't seen reported anywhere on the Ash study, is in maybe the exit interviews, questions like, well, you know, how's your life been over the last 1 month, 3 months? What happened to you today before you came in? I think those personal considerations are important.
Totally. And I mean, I think very much like the Milgram study, Ash didn't go deep in terms of looking at what differentiates the more conformist to the less conformist, what's their background and so forth. I had a couple of thoughts in what you were saying, because it was really interesting in what you said that brought up a lot of ideas for me. One was this. I think one thing that really comes out of this study and that is useful is that we know people will conform more or less depending on their circumstances. And some of the circumstances Ash has outlined, like whether or not you have an ally, whether or not there's a majority or there's a dissenter. He did other things like the size of the majority in the room. That has an influence. If it's like more people saying the wrong thing unanimously, then that's stronger up to a point. And then after a point, it doesn't really make much difference anymore. But the point is this. We know that circumstances can change the level of conformity. And I think the implication of that is this. If you are conscious of that, then you can design a life for yourself where you are as independent a thinker as possible by doing things like, for example, exposing yourself to all the different viewpoints on an issue that you want to have an independent view on, rather than staying with the, you know, with the sports fan crowd that was all shouting rah, rah, rah at one argument against the other sports fan crowd for the other argument, right? You can you can design a life for yourself where you are a more independent thinker. So that's something that I think is a really positive thing that I'm trying to get out of looking into this subject, is to think about how do we arm ourselves to be individualists and to be independent, rational thinkers. The other thing I thought about as you said this is, as I was saying, Ash didn't go into the why of the conformity thing. And you've talked a lot about the impact of school. And I think it's, you know, I'm super interested in what you've said about the role of school in conditioning people. And I think that's really important. I can imagine other explanatory variables as well. And obviously, parenting is one of them that you talk about a lot, too, in your podcast. The influence of kind of compliance-oriented parenting, where children at a very young, impressionable age are taught, you know, to obey authority figures and to not do things out of line and to comply and conform with the family and so forth. And I can also imagine that there may be deep evolutionary psychology reasons why we are prone to conformity, because it might be that the people who survived in our evolutionary past were the ones who, you know, didn't stick out from the tribe too much, right? I mean, that's possible too, because we now live in such different times than in our fairly vicious tribal past that it may have been a survival mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's a really good point. And I've often described the whole school experience as maybe more of a symptom of a problem with the human condition than the cause of that problem. And, you know, like I've said about the government that we have today, the state itself, it's more of a representation of things humans haven't figured out how to get right yet, right? Like a lot of political discourse that is considered to be completely acceptable by, you know, most voter standards, by the standards of the mainstream media. If you took that down to an individual level and had people behaving that way, it would be reprehensible, you know?
Absolutely.
But it's completely acceptable in that context. So, yeah, I'm careful to not pin all of this on school. I certainly saw this as a lesson that school teaches, basically through the milieu. Now, there was a conscious effort to have school function as a psychological conditioner. There are debates as to how successful that was, you know, those particular projects were, projects run by, you know, tax-free foundations, you know, run by...
Was it the Ford Foundation or I can't remember?
The Rockefeller Foundation. And, you know, they had projects. Those projects were executed. The result seems to be close to what they wanted. But is that a causal relationship? It's hard to tell. Did people do exactly what you said, maybe? Did they just follow a kind of evolutionary prescribed pattern? So I think that that's a really interesting question.
And I think, you know, I mean, I think it's really interesting to puzzle out why and to think about the impact of schooling and parenting and maybe evolutionary psychology and maybe other things too. But it's possible for us to change our minds about what might be the cause of this, but to still see the impact that conformity has on your own freedom. And, you know, whatever you believe to be the strongest evidence for the causes of conformity, whether you think it's really 90% family and 10% school and no evolution, or whether you think it's, you know, 20% evolution and 20% family and then mostly school, doesn't, you know, whatever. I think that's in a way a separate debate. The important mm-hmm. the important thing is that this is a huge force that can deny you from living the kind of life that you really want to live. And to live to the fullest extent of your individuality and be the greatest expression of yourself that you can be in life. Conformity is such an important psychological barrier to understand for everyone who's interested in freedom. And that's why I think, you know, it's such an interesting thing to look at how we can break it and live radically individuated lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a great foundation for being a healthy nonconformist, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, is practicing what Nathaniel Brandon identified as six pillars of self-esteem. You know, self-esteem is something that's gotten a lot of criticism. It's been seen as kind of a, you know, hippie, new agey kind of movement that's really just about surrender.
It's become something for some people. Self-esteem has become something about, you know, blowing yourself kisses in the mirror and telling yourself what a lovely person you are, regardless of what you do with your life, which I know was not what Nathaniel Brandon's idea in the origins of that concept was back in the sort of 60s and 70s when he invented that idea.
Yeah. And it's not just like you label yourself as high self-esteem or low self-esteem. It's that self-esteem, as he sums it up, is a collection of practices that you practice, you know, that it's ongoing, you know, it's like fitness or anything else that requires consciousness and maintenance. And I can just run through them really quick because I think it relates, you know, living consciously, this idea of confronting fears, dealing with maybe unresolved pain or childhood trauma, the kind of the less deep and more deep things that might contribute to somebody surrendering to a group. The second one, self-acceptance. You know, if somebody wasn't ready to accept themselves, they might put much more stock than is deserved in a group opinion.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because they need the group's validation.
Mm.
And then the big ones for nonconformists, really the next four. The third one, self-responsibility, you know, which is facing what Brandon called a kind of ultimate aloneness, fantasies of a rescuer, getting rid of fantasies of a rescuer, this idea that nobody's coming, that we are responsible, that we can't kind of like slip in to the mix of this group that mm-hmm. may be right or wrong, but at least we'll belong. And because we now have this collectivism, no one's really responsible. You know, it kind of goes to the something that I pointed out, like in the early days of the show, the separating, you know, how we talk about government or the military or something, using words like we versus using words like they.
Yeah,
you're not in a group, right? So people take some kind of comfort and some kind of, like, it's okay to say when we invaded Vietnam, you know, when we went into Vietnam. But what they're talking about, a decision made behind the closed doors of a room they weren't in with a bunch of foreign policy advisors they've never heard of, talking to a president they didn't vote for. But that's a we, so that's weird. But if you say, yeah, when I went into Vietnam, or when I carpet bombed Cambodia, or when I dropped the atomic bomb over Hiroshima, most people, if they heard themselves say that with any kind of conviction, they would recoil immediately in horror. But in the group, in the collective, there's this abdication of responsibility for everybody that's okay somehow.
Absolutely. So, I was just going to quickly interject. Do you know the Doug Stanhope clip about we beat the Germans in the Second World War?
I don't. I'd love to hear it.
I will. I'll put a link in the show notes because I won't be able to deliver it in the funny way that he does. But he's talking to some guy in a bar who says, "Yeah, well, we kicked the Germans' asses in the Second World War," and he says, "We, Bobby, did we do that? I mean, I know I drank a lot last night and I may have passed out for a while there, but I don't remember waking up, you know, with mud on my knees, and I don't remember storming the beaches, you know. I don't think we beat the Germans in the Second World War." So he's talking about this whole nationalist ideology of how, you know, whenever it's something that the country, in quote marks, has done, that people take that on as a personal identity.
Yeah, yeah. It's also, you can get pride from things you had nothing to do with. Like, I remember somebody describing the moon landing to me. It's like, it was just a great time of national pride. Why? You know? So it goes either way, but there's no individual identity either way. Whether you're trying to take pride in something you had nothing to do with, or you're trying to escape personal responsibility, collectivism, you know, has no individual identity or no focus on individual identity. You only are what you are to the group.
Yeah.
So the fourth pillar of self-esteem, self-assertiveness, which is essentially, you know, a courage to be authentic.
Yeah.
You know, without getting a preview of how others are going to respond.
Right.
You know, so you're not feeling out, you're not like polling like politicians do to see if it's okay if you say something. You're just being authentic and not really worried about the consequences that the group. And, you know, I mean, hopefully the consequences aren't too severe, but you're not acting completely with regard to how the group will respond.
Yes.
So that's self-assertiveness. Translates or moves in very nicely to the fifth one, living purposefully. Right?
Yeah. If you don't have your own sense of purpose in life, then you will be buffeted by the winds of conformity. Because you're not standing for anything. You haven't got anything that you're moving towards in your life. So consequently, I think that probably is what happens when people go from being conformist to the mainstream culture to being conformist to a subculture.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And it reminds me of where I grew up, Jake, in New England, kind of a sports area.
Right.
Right. And we have the Red Sox in Boston. And boy, is it wee when it comes to the Red Sox doing well.
Right.
And I know other comedians have pointed this out. Like, it's we when they win and it's they when they lose, you know?
Yeah.
But if people, and I'm not saying that everyone in New England lives completely without purpose, but you can see how if there is a personal purpose vacuum, it can be filled with things like moon landings and Red Sox.
Yeah.
You know?
And especially filled with anything that gets your fight or flight response going, you know. Like, yeah. You know, and sports can do that, right? It's exciting, yeah. It's physical, everyone gets excited because you don't have a higher purpose to think of. So you get drawn into the adrenaline excitement of simulated battle. I mean, it's essentially the whole bread and circuses thing again, you know?
Yeah. That was funny how apparently for a moment there I forgot that you're from England. And I'm like, see, Jake, over here, people take sports very seriously and they have like a collective identity that like you wouldn't know that. And the sixth one is living with integrity, choosing values and standing by them. And that sometimes means very hard choices and, you know, being at odds with much bigger, more intimidating and powerful groups.
Yeah, and I think that's reflected in some of the responses of the nonconformist in that ASH study as well, like the guys who were saying, well, I figured, you know, I should call it the way I see it. Now, that's integrity. mm-hmm. saying like, well, you know, maybe I am wrong or not. But, in that particular instance, obviously they wanted to give a truthful answer, what they considered to be the answer that would really reflected what they thought. So,
right, yeah.
I think that's really
the six
helpful.
Pillars, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really, really helpful. And it's been really fun talking to you about this study. I thought it was very interesting and had some interesting implications, especially because I hadn't really heard of it compared to the Milgram experiments and the Stanford Prison Experiment, which are much better known. And I know you've talked about those on your show. But I thought this was interesting, as I say, because it's about peer pressure. And it's not mm-hmm. so much about authorities and obedience, but it's about the influence of peer pressure. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about conformity, is, you know, that sideways pressure that keep people locked in lives that they don't necessarily really feel fulfilled in, and that they don't get to express their true selves in. And so that's why I wanted to talk about it. Is there anything that you think would be sort of any other last thoughts about this sort of conformity issue and other things that come to mind?
I really appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate you relating the problem of conformity to something really practical, you know, as far as living a freer life and you know, attaining more financial freedom or more professional freedom. I feel like it's been a while since I've visited this issue, and in the past it was really tied to essentially a school problem. So pointing out its importance to having a more fulfilled life, I think is really valuable, and I appreciate you letting me participate.
Well, my pleasure. And I'm also thinking about, we didn't really get a chance to speak so much about obedience and about apathy, which I think are really important issues for psychological freedom too. And as I'm still thinking about these things when I'm writing about them for my book, I might come back to you and see if you're interested in talking about those sometime too.
Please do. I would love that.
Great.
That'd be great.
Brett, where can people find you?
Sure. My website is schoolsucksproject.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, School Sucks Podcast is the username. And if people want to participate in conversations about school or educational issues or things that we're covering on the show, we have a group on Facebook just called School Sucks Project. If you search Facebook, you should find us.
I'll stick that in the show notes too.
Oh, absolutely.
It's been great fun chatting to you. Thanks so much for coming on, Brett.
Thank you, Jake.
Thank you for listening to The Voluntary Life. If you have feedback about the show, please email Jake at thevoluntarylife.com. If you enjoyed this program, please share the podcast with your friends or click the donate button on thevoluntarylife.com.